Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redston. Today I'm talking with Matt Harwood. If you're not sure who Matt is, he's a former school teacher who now runs his family's business, which is Harwood's Garage in Wootton. But outside of that, Matt is also a very keen and very accomplished surfer. And it's those parts of his life that we spend most of our time talking about. We do go into some of the other stuff as well, but I wanted to focus on the surfing part of it because it's such a big part of Matt's life and of the lives of many other people on the island. If you're not familiar, Matt is very closely involved with the Isle of Wight Surf Club. He is also the island's representative for the national organisation Surfers Against Sewage. With them, he does talks in local schools and things like that. And Matt is also, he's the national coach for the England Adaptive Surfing Team as well. So those are some of the things that we talk about. Without further ado, let's crack on with it, and I hope you enjoy my talk with Matt Harwood. So I'm here today with Matt Harwood. Hi Matt, how are you?
Hi,
lovely
Joe.
To see you.
Nice to see you.
Excellent, thanks ever so much for agreeing to talk to me today. Really appreciate that. So Matt, just to give me and the people listening a little bit of an idea about you, could you just give me a bit of background? Were you born on the island or did you move here? Or
yeah, I was born on the island. I was born and I grew up in Wootton, and I grew up alongside our family business, which was, or is, Harwood's Garage, and which was started by my grandparents, Percy, and yeah, grew up a lot there. I was very lucky and went to ride school, which was a lovely experience. Went there from the age of 3 or 4 all the way to 18, so I didn't know anything else. And then I went off to uni, went off to Plymouth University to study environmental science, and then went on to become a PE and geography teacher.
Ah, okay. So one of the things, the main reason that I wanted to talk to you today is I keep hearing your name when I talk to people who are involved with the water on the island, you know, primarily surfing. So where does surfing start to join the story for you?
So I loved sport as a kid, loved running around, just that physical movement, and loved being outdoors. Again, I was really lucky. I went for ski holidays with my parents and had a lovely time with my dad on the mountains, and probably about 13 I started skateboarding and loved my skateboarding and rugby. And then about 15 I saw Point Break, the movie, and realized that looked seriously cool, maybe the lifestyle I wanted. And yeah, started surfing about probably about 15, I think, and just fell in love with it, just became obsessed, and combined everything I liked, being outdoors, the sort of motion of snowboarding and skateboarding all together, and it was on my doorstep. So
okay. And very recently on the island there was what I believe was the first surf competition in quite a few years. Have I done my research right there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was, so tell us a little bit about that then, please.
So yeah, with the surf clubs, I think it's maybe the oldest or one of the oldest in the UK, the Isle of Wight Surf Club. But it's had bouts and spells over the years that it's been very vibrant and people have come and gone, and it's fallen by the wayside. And I think the last time we had a contest was maybe 2011, oh, wow, something like that. And James Ranson has made a really big, who lives on the island, he's a teacher. He's come along and really got everyone back together and put this a community on the road again with the surf club. And I used to be the chairman, and actually with the other things I do, it just became a little bit more too much to do. So James has taken on that role of chairman and is doing a great job. And yeah, we had our first contest maybe a month ago now, and it was really fitting actually, because we did it in a memorial contest for my really good friend Lee Sheaf, who passed away 5 years ago. Actually, he passed away June the 3rd, 5 years ago. So yeah, so it's a day after. Yeah, we did it in honor of him, and it was lovely. His parent, his dad Dave came down, and his wife Fleur came down, and it was a really lovely contest. And although the waves weren't great, we had a great longboard contest, and the best part of it for me was just seeing the number of women and kids who are surfing now.
Yeah, I was going to say that actually. That was what really jumped out at me, was exactly what you've just said. You know, really healthy junior competition and lots of ladies getting in the water as well. Is that sort of typical of surfing, or is that a bit unusual down here on the island?
I think for the first time ever, we've got a large number of kids regularly going surfing together as a group. And we've also got, for the first time ever, a really large group of women. And I think there's even a couple of groups of women now, sort of like different age groups of girls going surfing. And it's so nice to see, actually, because I mean, I've got a daughter myself, and I've got three sisters, and obviously got a mum. And but it's really healthy to see everyone in the water.
Yeah, no, that's cool. And so what's next for the Isle of Wight Surf Club then?
I think we've had success in the past with sort of interclub competitions over the years, like at the national levels, but it's always been amongst the men. And I think what needs to happen now is we build on the success of that contest. And actually, if you go to clubs like Croyd down in Devon, they've got a really vibrant community of people. So when a contest is on, there's mums and dads all out helping put together a nice hot soup at the lunchtime, and it is a community. People are talking together, socializing together, and actually I think it's you become a much stronger group of people. Okay. And stakeholders when things start to happen on your coastlines.
Okay, I mean, we'll come on to, you mentioned the coastlines there, and that's definitely another thing that I want to come back to a little bit later. But before we do, one of the things that I find interesting about surfing, it has a whole language, like surfers, you know, the words that they use to describe the waves and all that kind of stuff. And it can almost seem like, you know, a foreign language at times as well. And I think from some of the people that I've spoken to, sometimes that can be maybe a little bit of a barrier of entry for people. Is that something that you find, that because it's quite a specialized sport, does that put people off?
I think historically, and probably, people feel protective over their waves.
Right.
So it's a very strange sport. If you go and play rugby, 15 of you go out and play as a team. When you go out surfing, inherently it's just based around yourself, and it's about your enjoyment. And therefore, like anything these days, there's a limited resource. And for us, the limited resource sometimes is the number of waves available or the amount of space left in the water to surf. And I think people become quite protective and take ownership of surf breaks and beaches. Even on the island, it's, and elsewhere in the world, you can turn up to places and it can be very localized. So, and that can give a sort of, it can put people off. They can have a negative experience. And it's a really fine balance between accepting people in the water, but also don't feel like, because you've been there for so long, you feel like an inherent ownership of it.
Yeah.
But I think it's about that two-way conversation with people, accepting new people, but the new people coming in, just being respectful and... Yeah. And courteous. Yeah.
Okay. And so for anyone listening who might be interested in getting involved in surfing, there's a number of different ways, I think, to get involved on the island. What would you say from your experience would be a good first step for someone to start surfing?
So on the Isle of Wight, I would go to, you've got a choice, really. You've got someone like Chris Mannion, who runs iSurf, who's got, can cater for groups of people. So it means you can go in with friends, and you've got that as a really lovely facility. He's mobile as well, so he can be anywhere on the island where there's surf, he can meet you. And he's got all the wetsuits and boards. I'd say that if you've already started, you might want to go and see someone like Eddie Cole, who's like a very, very good and experienced surfer as well. Eddie's a South African, he lives here. But when you talk to him, I'd say he's one of these people that really studies surf. Like, he knows good technique and he'll look at it. And I think he's someone, if you wanted like a one-to-one lesson to really bring your technique on, he'd be a good port of call. So both of those guys. And then there's people like Scott Gardner, who runs Whitewater down at Lake. Scott, like, Whitewater's been there forever. I think that was a basis, like, for so many of us starting. That was one of our first experiences. And he's got an absolutely fantastic setup down there. of equipment, of and you might find it's not surfing you want. You might find that you fall in love with windsurfing or sailing, but someone like Scott is a great go-to for that.
And there's, yeah, I actually used to go to the splash sessions on Saturday mornings at Whitewater myself, and have pretty clear memories. I think I would have been about 9 or 10 of, I think it would have probably been Ross, like, yeah, you know, could barely reach the boom on the windsurf, but, you know, was already kind of much better than anyone else down there.
Absolutely. And I mean, Ross has gone on to become genuinely one of the best windsurfing athletes in the world, like year on year. And yeah, I mean, that, and he started on the Isle of Wight. Yeah. So,
And I mean, Ross is probably the most obvious example of people from the island who've gone on to do stuff in water sports, but are there other people out there that I might not have come across?
So probably in terms of surfing, the first name that springs to mind is Johnny Fryer. Right. So Johnny, we were talking about this, Johnny and I, the other day, the first time we ever sort of met each other, and I was in the water, and I must have been, I don't know, like I said, 15 16, and he was like 9, and he was incredible then. And he's got this amazing mum, Jill Fryer, and they own a farm out the West White, and she used to take him everywhere for every day for a surf. And Johnny's gone on to become like British champion and English champion.
I didn't realize that.
An amazing level surfer. And he lives down in St. Ives now, does surf coaching and stuff down there. So actually, if you wanted a trip down for surf coaching with an island connection, Johnny would be fantastic. But really lovely guy, another guy who really thinks about his surfing and studies it, and yeah, top chap. But yeah, I'd say Johnny's probably like our most famous export on that front.
Okay, that's cool. And another thing that I'm kind of just curious about, not just in terms of surfing and water sports, but just in life. So slightly strange question for you, Matt, but what's a bad piece of advice that you hear given in relation to surfing on a regular basis?
I don't know if it's advice, but I think people try and make a huge leap in performance in terms of their equipment. So rather than just wanting to progress, the fastest way to progress in surfing is to catch as many waves as possible and ride them for as long as possible. And that will help your learning curve. I think a lot of people see a magazine, a video online, and they see everyone on these like short little like toothpick boards, and they go, that's for me. And actually that might be for you, but actually, to begin with, straight away, that's not a good starting point. And I think if you get honest advice about having enough volume and length within your board like that, I think you're going to start catching waves and having fun. And actually, it doesn't matter that it doesn't look as cool as a shortboard, because actually, if that's where you want to get to, you'll get there much quicker and have a lot more fun. We were I think most of our generation, we grew up, when I started, it was like 1990 something, like 91. And it was the era of really, really skinny boards. And I don't know how I carried on surfing, because you look at those boards now and they don't look surfable. And but I think that was a whole raft of people. And probably we lost a lot of surfers because of their frustrations at not having a good enough time on it.
That's interesting. Interesting. Okay, so coming back just a few minutes ago, you mentioned about the coastline, and that's another thing that you're pretty actively involved with, which is Surfers Against Sewage. Is that right?
Yeah.
Excellent. So for people who maybe aren't familiar with SAS, as they are known, could you just give us a little overview as to who they are and what they do?
Sure. So SAS, Surfers Against Sewage, were formed, I think, about 1991. In Cornwall. And as their name suggests, they were a group of surfers who banded together to try and improve our water quality. At the time, the easiest and quickest and cheapest way, most importantly for a water company, to dispose of our sewage was to pump it out to sea. And they reasoned that if they pumped it far enough out to sea, all would be well. But obviously, it doesn't matter how far you pump out to sea, if the wind's coming back onto shore or somewhere else, it's going to take all your toilet waste and everything back onto the beaches. And I can clearly remember in the early 90s surfing at Shanklin, and I think most other people testify, you could smell this horrific smell. And that no one wanted to admit it, but that was Shanklin's waste. And Surfers Against Sewage did an amazing job over those years and brought in huge legislation to force the water companies to UV treat it, primary, secondary and tertiary treatments of your sewage, and water companies don't like it because they've got to invest in infrastructure for that to happen, and that hits their profits. But I think the two remits of a water company actually are, the two basic remits are that they have to supply clean, drinkable, potable water. And then the second one is that they have to dispose of it cleanly. But yeah, and so that's changed massively now. And I think it's pretty rare for me to smell or see sewage. However, our infrastructure is still really limited on that front. Most of our towns in Britain have got a Victorian sewer system because that's when our towns were built. And every time it rains, or especially heavy rain, they can't take the volume of human waste and water waste along with all the rainfall. So they only have one other option, which is to open up their CSOs, which are combined sewer outflows. So rather than your sewers in your street overflowing and it coming up, they open it and let it out into the sea. So actually, SAS have got a fantastic app. It's called Safer Seas app. And it's done in conjunction with the Environment Agency. And you can see live where beaches like Yavelin, Sandown, Shanklin, Gurnard, when they're discharging. So it actually informs you before someone goes in the water. You can make an informed decision about whether you want to go in there or put your children in there. Right. So, and it's interesting, like it's not a popular app. It's a popular app for water users. Yeah. But obviously businesses don't want it. And I totally understand that because they feel it could damage their business. Mm-hmm. However, I don't think businesses should worry because it's not just here on the island. Yeah, it's absolutely all over the UK.
Yeah. And I would say, just from my own experiences, having spent a large part of my life kind of in and around Sandown Bay, I would say from my own personal experiences that the water in Sandown Bay is definitely clearer and cleaner than it was when I was growing up.
Absolutely.
I mean, you go down there and it is crystal clear, you know, you can, when it's been, you know, still for a few days and the waves aren't churning the sand up, you can, yeah, it's beautiful down there. So that's cool. And so, okay, thanks for that. That's brilliant. So I really understand what SAS are all about. And so what do you do personally to kind of spread that message?
So with SAS, that was their initial outset to do. But actually, they've taken on a different role. And their name is probably, or our name is SAS, has probably become, has changed. But so we're called SAS. And actually, our remit of what we do is much more than just sewage now. We've, over the years, we've also seen the threatening of surf breaks and beaches being developed for harbours or developments on sea defences and things like that. And for us, a surf break for us is as valued. It would be like someone saying, oh, I'm going to develop this golf course. And people love their golf courses, right, just like we love our surf breaks. Okay. And you'll get like a reef where you've got a certain section of rock that causes a wave to break. And that's got a real value to it. So at SAS, if there's a wave under threat, we'll look at it and see if we can try and protect it. Because actually waves have got, as well as like an enjoyment value, which you can't quantify, waves around the world have got an economic value as well.
Okay.
So somewhere like Portugal, if you go to areas of Portugal, yeah, their whole towns now are built around surf schools and...
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's,
you see that like North Devon, Cornwall, places. Absolutely. Like that as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. And even here, I mean, if you've got businesses like iSurf, Whitewater, Eddie Cole Surf Coaching, yeah, Exile at Bembridge, yeah, all of these businesses rely on having a resource to use. So yeah, that's,
and I mean, just bringing it back to the island a little bit there, how good is the resource here? Because I've seen, you know, I think I was a bit surprised at some of the pictures that I saw over in the winter time of some of the waves that were coming in at Freshwater, yep, and Compton and places like that. They really did look, I mean, to someone who doesn't know much about it, I was kind of going, oh my god, that's like, you know, that's a fairly serious looking wave. They're, yeah, pretty large, right?
Absolutely. So we're I think we're really blessed here with our waves, but I think we get fantastic waves, like really good waves, especially in winter, but we don't get them often. So you'll get consistent surf here, but I always describe it as consistently average. So you just have to go. And I sort of think of it like maybe like a Scottish ski resort, like Aviemore. I'm sure on that day they have beautiful days, yeah, But a lot of the time you're skiing in really cold, wet, windy Scottish conditions. But it produces really good skiers from that area as well. And I sort of think of it like that. There are better waves in Cornwall and Devon on a consistent basis. Mm-hmm. However, our physical setup, like our headlands and things like that, that can cause us to have, with a really good swell and the right conditions, like you could go and have an amazing surf here and go, if I had that anywhere else in the world,
there'd be so hundreds happy. Of people kind of coming in.
Absolutely. But that consistency isn't there. So right now we're in June and we're probably coming up to about 3 to 4 weeks of flatness. It's really bad at the moment.
Okay. And so 3 to 4 weeks, so you're able to make predictions that far in advance?
No, we haven't had waves for 3 or 4 weeks.
I was going to say, crikey, weird surfer magic going on there.
I think probably about 7 days is about pretty accurate. 10 days you can get a feel what might be out there.
Okay.
But the modelling that they use.
Because I see people, you know, on their phones and stuff, and as I say, talking that foreign language, but, you know, talking about, you know, high pressures and low pressures and swells and all this stuff coming in. But, I mean, it's not, I guess, like it was even 10 years ago, right? Like in all areas of life, the technology's changed it.
So that's going back to earlier about the number of people in the water. That's changed it massively. So years ago, my poor mum would drive me to the surf and it would be flat and like that. And then you'd go home and then find out there was surf the next day. And you're like, and it was just, I mean, we worked off CFAX. Seriously. So we'd look at CFAX and then you'd phone like shops elsewhere, see if anyone had seen it on a landline. And you'd be working off like the Times newspaper, like the isometric bars on, do you know what I mean? The meteorological maps. And that's all you had to go on. Okay. But right now I could find out what the forecast looks like for this week. And I could find out how big the swell is in the channel right now. So actually, I can't remember the last time I went for a surf and there wasn't surf because do you know what I mean? And that's amazing for performance of surfers as well. Because actually, if you've got that consistency, rather than driving around on a goose chase.
Yeah, you get a better chance to practice and improve and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well. Cool. So just bringing it back to kind of your involvement with SAS. Again, I might have kind of misunderstood something here, but I believe you either were or are going around to some of the local schools talking about some of the things that SAS do.
Like I said, it's got loads of faces now, Surfers Against Sewage. And the last 2 years, we've always done beach cleans. But as a surfer who surfed since I was 15 and I'm now 40, I think anyone like that has seen our beaches get progressively worse in terms of the quality of what sits on them, in terms of marine litter and debris. And so that's become a real forefront of our campaigning the last few years. And then last year, we released a huge campaign called Plastic Free Coastlines. And the idea is to try and get communities on board as a plastic free coastline. And with that, because we thought about it on the island and we're like, well, we could maybe get New Church to come on board, but that's not going to be too hard because you could get the school and a pub and the garlic farm and you're done. But actually the real value is, could we get the whole Isle of Wight on board with it? So end of last year, fantastic girl called Cordelia Dewey came on board as another rep on the island. And so we had a launch night a couple of months ago where we invited businesses from all over the island and presented to them. And actually we're on our way. And businesses, it's not a huge onerous thing. They need to give up 3 pieces of plastic within their sort of day-to-day work. So for a cafe, it could be they don't do disposable plastic forks and they get rid of sachets. Things like that. And they don't sell plastic water bottles. Do you know what I mean? And it's doable. It's really doable. And the same for schools. And for the schools, we've got a program where the schools can write to governance, like whether that's their MP or councillor, saying, please, can we do something about this? And they can do their own beach clean. And then as a school, they take it on as an ethos, like, actually, we're a plastic-free school. And that becomes the way of thinking.
Okay, so that's presumably quite a long-term thing. We're not expecting, or maybe we are expecting overnight results, I don't know.
No, but I think we've to fulfill our requirement to get plastic-free status or a plastic-free coastline, we need to get 40 businesses on board, 15 schools on board, and we need to get the council on board. But the council have been really open to it, actually. Okay, cool. Yeah. And so, but because there's so many different combinations, and we've got to make sure that if a business is doing it, they are doing it. So, and it's making sure that, and we can try and give them some advice, send them to suppliers to do that as well. Because plastic is just, yeah, it's really kicked off with David Attenborough and Blue Planet 2 last year or earlier this year. It just went berserk. But actually it was the catalyst that was needed to really get it moving.
Yeah, you get someone like that talking about it publicly and suddenly the awareness seems to have gone through the roof.
I don't think you can argue with David Attenborough. You just can't.
I certainly wouldn't. Not about something like
that. He knows the world.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not many of us who've seen as much of it as he has, that's for sure. Okay, so that's cool. So you'd be interested, obviously, in hearing from any businesses who maybe wanted to get involved with this and schools as well.
Absolutely.
And then what about on a kind of personal level as well? So I've seen a few things recently, you know, what seem to be very simple things. You know, every time you go to the beach, try and pick up 3 pieces of plastic. Is that an SAS program or is that one that's just turned up from somewhere else?
SAS encourage like the mini beach clean.
Right.
You've got your 2-minute beach clean as well.
Oh, okay.
So, but I mean, globally, there's like amazing things like the Final Straw. So they're an organization where they're trying to get businesses to give up plastic straws. I mean, that's something a cafe can do. Yeah. Get rid of plastic straws and don't offer straws at all unless they're requested for. And then you give a cardboard straw out.
Yeah.
But people have got to remember that every bit of plastic that's ever been produced on this planet still exists today, which is frightening. So every time you get your shopping and you take your food out, and it's so hard to avoid it. But actually, by people making those decisions small, supermarkets work off, they'll sell things that sell. Yep. So if you can keep asking for things or trying to choose products that haven't got plastic, they'll see a pattern there. And
I mean, that's something, you know, when we were chatting before we started recording, that's something that I feel really, really strongly about is, I think that's something that a lot of people maybe would think, oh, it doesn't make that much difference. I'm only one person. You know, if I stop doing this, it doesn't make any difference in the grand scheme of things. But that's not personally how I see it. And I guess you're kind of the same, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's just those small changes. And I think people, I've got friends who are quite radical with it. Do you know what I mean? But also I feel like I'm realistic in the fact that you can't just eliminate plastic from your life like that. And it's about trying to choose. When I go for my mayonnaise, I choose a glass jar over a plastic squeezy jar because the glass is recyclable, it's got an economic value to it, and the plastic at the moment hasn't.
And I mean another simple one that somebody said to me was just about bananas. It's, you know, bananas, you peel a banana, right? So you don't need the bananas to also be in a plastic bag.
No.
Because they are already protected. So, you know, there's simple things that I think all of us can do, right?
Yeah, it is. It's really doable. That's the thing. Carry, 10 years ago, no, 50, where were we? 20 years ago, I'd have left my house with my wallet and my house keys. Yeah. Probably 15 years ago, I'm leaving with my mobile phone as well, as that became part of my life. And now I have a water bottle with me, and I even have a coffee cup as well. So if I know I'm going to be out, and I just put it in my rucksack
and it's there.
And sorry, all I was gonna say was, if you bring your own cup as well, loads of cafes as well on the island have come on board with this. They'll give you a reduction in your coffee and teas, and all the big boys do as well. Starbucks, Costa, you get a cheaper coffee if you bring your own cup.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. So that's another thing that we can do for sure. Cool, thanks for all that, Matt. The other place that I keep hearing your name, which is, you know, really fascinating to me, is adaptive surfing. Is that, have I got the right expression there?
Yeah,
so adaptive surfing. So just explain to us what adaptive surfing is, and then we'll go into some details.
So if you think like Paralympics with disabled athletes, it's the term used for surfing. So athletes with a physical disability and adapting to surf, hence the adaptive part. So
you're talking about adaptive disabilities. What, before we go into where you're involved with it, what sort of disabilities might we be talking about here?
So the athletes I work with, they might have been born with something like cerebral palsy, or they might have had a trauma in their life where they've had an accident and paralysis, or they've lost a limb or
right. So we're talking
physical disabilities.
Quite, you know, quite extreme. Forgive me if I'm using slightly the wrong language here, but yeah, quite extreme disabilities.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. And then, so how did you get involved with that then?
So I've got a friend, Nick Rees, who's the operations manager at Surfing England, and about 2 years ago, he went to with the England team to the Adaptive World Championships. And Nick came back and said how amazing his experience was. I saw it on, as you do nowadays, like on Facebook and Instagram, and he said it was amazing. I mean, Nick's a really talented guy. He was went to the Commonwealth Games as a hockey player and like really knows his stuff. And he was just so excited about his experience there. So anyway, later last year, maybe June time, I saw Surfing England were looking for a volunteer and a coach and a manager to work with the Surfing England adaptive team. So I thought, okay, try that. I mean, and knowing Nick and knowing what an amazing experience he had, I was just like, well, if someone like that thought it was that good, yeah, I'd like a little bit of that.
Yeah. So what's your role with the adaptive surfing?
So last year I went as a volunteer, right, and ended up at the event kind of becoming the coach. And so this year they've named me England coach for the adaptive surfing team.
Congratulations.
Which is lovely. Yeah, it's a really lovely sort of thing. But so later this month, end of the month, we've got the English Adaptive Surfing Championships down in Fistral, in Cornwall, in Newquay. And that's the 30th of June. I think that's the Saturday. Yeah. And so we, last year we had the championships. We had athletes from all over the world coming here, and I think we've got another sort of international lineup of people. But the adaptive community, that's still really new to me, but they're an amazing bunch of people. Yeah, like amazing. Just people who get up in the morning and just crack on.
So just coming back to the adaptive element of it, so how does that work? So thinking about, you know, you said so with the Paralympics, do they have sort of guides and assistance, or is the equipment adapted, or how does that side of it work?
So equipment is definitely adapted, right. So so it's probably easier, like they normal surfing, you stand up and you ride. Obviously for some of these athletes, if someone's quadriplegic, yeah, like that, and paralyzed from the neck down, they need assistance. So some of those guys have got enough strength to put weight through their arms, like through their elbows. So they would lay prone on a board and then they would have someone guide them into a wave. They say which wave they want, they're put in, and then they'll have someone at the end in case they flip over, because obviously, but they can start to steer their board like that. But then you also, that's probably the far extreme. And then you have, there's a guy called Benoit, French guy, really fun guy. I don't know how he lived, but whenever I see him on Instagram, he's snowboarding or surfing. I don't know what, I don't think he does work. But Benoit lost his arm, like a tree fell on it, and lost his arm, but continues to surf, but probably rides like a slightly bigger, more volume board, because obviously to paddle into a wave, he's only got one arm to paddle in. And then we've got, there's a lovely guy called, and when I say this, his name is Peg. His name's Peg Leg Bennett. So Peg lives in Cornwall. He's a real character, but Peg's got one leg, and I think, as I understand it, he was born with his foot didn't form right when he was born, so they opted to remove his foot. So he's got like a bit of leg lower than his knee, and because of that, he changed his name by Depot to Peg Leg Bennett. So when I was trying to book flights last year with Virgin, who helped us like get the team over to California, I kept on having to explain that his name was Peg Leg Bennett. He had one leg. That's his real name. And even had to show, like send a picture of a passport to prove it.
Okay. Yeah. Cause that's, yeah, that would feel like you weren't being serious for sure.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, there's guys like Spike, the guy called Spike Kane, who's, I'd say Spike's one of the most amazing human beings I've ever met. From Liverpool originally, moved to Seattle, like fully abled, no issues, boat builder, built wooden boats. And Spike moved to Seattle, and he's a really cool guy to speak to. He grew up in he was in Seattle in the 90s, so he saw the whole grunge thing happen there, and he's got some cool stories about that. But I think maybe 15 years ago, he had a motorcycle accident and was left paralyzed in two parts of his spine. So, and because of that, he is wheelchair bound now. But his outlook on life is just incredible. I mean, the guy put together two other guys, and they sailed up the whole coast of Alaska on their own, all paralyzed. So all they could do was crawl around the boat. Yeah. Goodness. And just undertaking feats that most people don't even start to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And perspective. Yeah, it really does. And yeah, Spike's is just hilarious. Like, you can't stop. You will cry with laughter, and your ribs will hurt every time you see him. But yeah.
And so you've got the event on the 30th, and you mentioned sort of international competitors. Do you guys get a chance to travel as well, or is that maybe something that might happen down
the
line?
So last year I went to the World Championships in La Jolla in San Diego, and that was amazing. So, like, I think there was 41 countries and then 109 surfers. So you do a big, like, you have the big parade of nations with the flags and everything. And then... And for that week, you're just hanging out with these amazing people that just really get life right. So, and they're a community. It's unlike any sporting event I've ever been to, in the fact that everybody's so supportive of each other. When they're in the water, it's a competition.
Right.
But out of the water, everybody's trying to help each other and... Yeah, it's incredible.
Wow, that's cool. And again, just coming back to a little bit more info about your role. So obviously you're kind of supporting the team and actually coaching them in terms of offering kind of technique and advice and that kind of
stuff. Yeah, we'll be this year.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so taking a bit more on. So following the Nationals, the end of this month, we'll select our team.
Right.
And then hopefully we're going to have a bit of a program trying to get the guys and girls on it. We've got a lovely girl called Charlotte. She won silver last year at the Worlds.
Okay.
Which is amazing. And so I've tied her up actually already with Johnny Fryer down in Cornwall.
Right, gotcha.
So we've got the island collection in there. Johnny's coaching Charlotte and she's progressing really well. So
cool. And then, I might have missed this, but do you know when the next World Championships
The Worlds are? Will be in probably in December.
December. And do you know where, do you get to go somewhere exciting for that?
Probably, I think it will be back to San Diego.
San Diego, which is pretty cool, right?
It's a lovely part of the world.
Yeah, not too bad at all. So, I mean, okay, so there's San Diego. So where else, I mean, has your kind of surfing life taken you? Anywhere else exciting?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of us who surf have kind of, got on the road, whether it's just across to France or Portugal and then places like Indonesia and Bali Western Australia is pretty amazing. And
Have you got a favourite of the places that you've been to?
Western Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sort of red, like the red bluff cliffs and the blue ocean, Indian Ocean, is pretty amazing sight. Yeah. And really
slightly
good
more predictable waves, I think, as well.
Yeah, really consistent. Yeah, like sort of a Mediterranean climate. And
very nice.
California is good fun, though.
Yeah. What's on the list that you haven't made it to so far in terms of destinations? Is there like a surf spot that is like, that's the one that you need
I'd
to get
I'd really
to?
Like to go to Chile.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is it about Chile? I wasn't expecting that.
So I'd like to get I quite like surfing in cold water.
Okay.
Like I'm pretty fair skinned. So yeah, I don't deal well in the tropics. So, but yeah, I'd love to go to Chile. I just think it looks, from what people have said, it was like, it's like an untouched California.
Right. Okay.
So really good waves, cold, but yeah. Amazing people, apparently. So,
yeah, that sounds good. We've talked an awful lot about surfing, but I was going to ask you what you do to kind of chill out and relax. But I mean, I guess surfing is a big part of that. But what else is there in your life outside of the surfing?
My family.
Yeah. Okay.
Definitely. I've got a lovely wife, Claire. Amazing wife, Claire, and two cool kids, Micah and Beau. And
they surf.
Bo's really enjoying it.
Yeah.
She's seven and she loved it straight away. My little boy, Micah, he just wants to always work things out and suss it out and make sure he knows everything before he does something. But he's just starting to. He actually rode a little wave yesterday, actually, for the first time with his sister on a paddleboard. But he was pretty happy with himself about that. But yeah, he's just... But what I won't ever do is... force them to do it. I think that's from being a PE teacher and also being at surf contests for years, you see pushy parents, and it's a pretty fast way to turn your kids off from something if they're trying to fulfill your dreams over what they want to do and be happy. So, yeah.
Sounds good to me. Sounds good to me. So I think for a lot of people who come across you, again, obviously the surfing is a huge part of that. Little bit of a left turn here, but if you don't mind sharing, if you tell me something that might surprise people about you, because obviously, as I say, you've got a bit of a, a bit of a profile with the Isle of Wight Surf Club and with all the things that you do. Is there anything else? You know, have you got any little dark secrets somewhere that might surprise people?
I don't think so. Like, I'm pretty, I don't think so, Joe, actually. I'm a creature of habit, actually. So I mean, there's things I'd love to do, but I think it's always that compromise between doing too many things and not getting your work done properly and not looking after your family properly. And
So, I mean, is there another thing? So you mentioned skiing. I think you were doing
a bit. Yeah, I love snowboarding. Yeah, snowboarding. In fact, probably the thing that genuinely, if someone said you can go and live in the mountains and not surf and have good snow, I'd actually go and do that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, I think that would surprise most people. So I think that's probably quite a good one. And then outside of the board sports is obviously a big connection there. Is there something else? Is there another skill or another sport or another, I don't know, is there something else that you'd really like to kind of learn and get stuck into at some point?
I'd like to, there's things like windsurfing. I've never ever picked up a windsurfer or a kite in my life, but actually it's the time again. It's that time to, and I'm one of those people, if I want to do something, I'd usually like to try and do it. Yeah. I'm ultra competitive actually. Yeah.
Okay. So going back to being a beginner is.
Yeah. I'm ultra competitive. Yeah, absolutely. Like I genuinely don't mind losing if I don't care about it.
Right.
But if I really care about something and I feel like I haven't done as well as I should have done at something, if I've done my best, I'm like, I'm okay with it. But if I haven't or feel cheated, I'm like, bear with a sore head.
Right. Okay. So and where did that come from? Is that just kind of a part of your nature, or can you track that back to maybe something that happened, you know, when you were growing up or?
No, maybe part of my nature, but also probably ride school. When you look back at it from me being a PE teacher at a state school for so long and then looking back to ride school, I'm sure it's changed a lot, but it was pretty elitist. It was just like first teams. Do you know what I mean? Like you wanted to be in the first team. You wanted to be winning on sports days and everything like that. And actually that's great for people like me who really enjoy that. But from a PE teacher's perspective, you realize it's a pretty fast way to turn kids off physical activity. Because actually, why would a kid want to run cross country on a cold December's day if that's not their thing? But actually, for me, it was just like, this is amazing fun. But some kids don't get it. So
yeah. And so you were a teacher in a PE teacher in a state school, correct? How long did you do that for?
I was a teacher for about 12 years.
And was that on the island as well?
Yeah.
Okay. And you know, education on the islands, I mean, this is a bit of a left turn from surfing, but education on the islands been in the news a lot recently, you know, with the problems with Sandown and all that kind of stuff. As I say, if you're comfortable talking about this kind of stuff, was there a reason why you came away from teaching?
I definitely found it the biggest shift. I used to work at Ride High, really liked it. I had a great fun there, but just got to a point where just needed a change.
Okay.
And actually the lovely opportunity came up at Sandown High when it was still a sports academy. Yeah. And Sandown High, when I went there, was kind of everything from growing up on the island and having friends at Sandown High of my age. It was everything I sort of envisaged it would be. It still had a kind of maybe a grammar school feel to it with the house systems and really like there was like always like a school play going on and like loads of sport going on. And it was a really healthy environment. But I think the biggest shift, the most dramatic shift, was when the academies came in for me. And actually I saw a lot of really respected older teachers just fall by the wayside, because actually the academies are remote. They're like sending specialists down from the mainland and all of this. And I just think it lost what it was. And we went from Sandown High School to suddenly being Sandown Bay Academy. And actually when you start to lose a lot of those older teachers because they're so disillusioned, you start to lose the fabric of what that community is.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Sandown High, and I'm sure, like many people who were there, you know, those characters, you know, Mr. Thatcher and Mr. Baker and
absolutely,
all those kind of people, they were, you know, they were institutions. They were a hugely important part
absolutely
of what the school was. So does that worry you at all going forward? Obviously, your kids, I think you said, were 5 and 7.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're kind of heading into that world now. Is that something that bothers you?
So at the moment, they're at a lovely primary school, New Church, which I think is a lovely, like, it's got a lovely feel to it. You walk in and it just feels like a community school. Yeah, it does worry me a little bit what to do with kids when, I think for me, the hardest thing was we just got bigger and bigger classes as a teacher. And then you were just, and I think teachers are still under that pressure to get amazing results, but with less time, less resources. And actually what happens is I think that you've got your kids who are always going to do okay. Yeah. They've got like a stable family and whatever. Do you know what I mean? They're intelligent and they're good. They're well-behaved, polite kids, and they'll do fine. But they'll end up with a B. But actually, if you could have given them more time, could they have got an A star? Do you know what I mean? Could they be finishing their GCSEs with 10 A stars rather than 10 Bs, which suddenly puts them on another level for universities, and if that's the way they want to go. You then get so much time taken up with kids through ill discipline and behavior, which is emotionally really demanding and psychologically demanding on a teacher. But what tends to happen as well is you get told that you need to get everyone C's. So you focus on everyone trying to get everyone C's. So you then start to think, well, who's got a D? So you focus on those kids on a D, trying to get them a C for GCSE. But actually there's that lovely quiet group who don't say boo to a goose, and they're lovely and they're polite, but they don't get the time and attention. And that's how I sort of felt it. I felt like, and as teachers, you just felt like it was relentless. Do you know what I mean? Just,
yeah. And I mean, I don't want to, you know, like massively put you on the spot here. And, you know, I mean, God, you know, if we were to look at the education system, you know, I have no idea how that might get solved of someone who's been in it. Do you have any thoughts and suggestions on what maybe we could change?
I haven't seen on the Isle of Wight an academy really work. Right. I don't think, but then I don't work at Ride High. And Ride High, from what I hear from staff who work there, say they're enjoying it. And so maybe it does work. Yeah. But I think it's about that. It would be good if you had heads that stayed there for a prolonged period of time. I think I went there when John Bradshaw was there. He was a really lovely man. But then I think I saw 2 or 3 heads with AET really quickly. And that, you need to get someone who's in there for the long run. Do you know what I mean? Who's committed to moving to the island, maybe with their family, and actually setting a whole, like, ethics within a school. Do you know what I mean? You try and get everyone on board. And I think a lot of teachers felt, you just became a number with AET. You were just seen as a person in front of the classroom, and
it's tricky times. I've got, you know, several friends who've left teaching recently, and when you talk to them, you can see why. It's a difficult time, isn't it? You're losing, you know, good people from the profession, and yeah, it's hard to see.
But my motivation for leaving wasn't I moved into our family business through family circumstance. My dad passed away, and it just seemed like it was just the right thing to do at the time. Do you know what I mean? And I'm really glad I did. Yeah. Work with really nice people at the garage. And
yeah. No, that's cool. Matt, we're just kind of drawing to a close now. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for that. Before we wrap up, is there kind of anything else you'd like to pass on? Any kind of asks that you've got for the listeners? Anything you'd like them to maybe take away from our conversation today?
Well, I mean, if there's any schools or businesses out there in terms of plastic-free coastlines.
Cool. And what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I think we are...
Don't worry about it. We'll put some links in the show notes and things like that.
Yeah.
So I will make sure that people are able to get hold of you.
I'll give you our email and our Facebook page and everything like that.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I'll put all that stuff in the links. And once again, Matt, really appreciate your time today. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a real pleasure. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
So there we go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt Harwood. If you did want to get in touch with Matt and Cordelia, the best way to do that is via email, and they are iowsurfersagainstsewage@gmail.com. That's iowsurfersagainstsewage@gmail.com. There's links to that and everything else that Matt and I talked about in the show notes, and you can find those at my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. joeredston.com. And if you enjoyed this show, please do subscribe, look out for our next one, tell your friends all about us, and yeah, if you're feeling really kind, you could even leave us a review on iTunes. That would be amazing. So thanks very much, and we'll see you again next time. Cheers.